Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's called invisible computing. It's a way to do all of your online tasks without a screen. And accomplishing that is one of the next steps in tech innovation. Instead of pulling out a phone or a laptop, you could simply pop in your contact lenses, look out the corner of your eye, scroll online updates. The concept isn't new. Several companies are pursuing them, but one company called Mojo Vision unveiled a prototype recently with features that could also help seeing impaired people and provide invisible computing features for the masses down the road. Julian Chokatu is a senior associate editor at Wired Magazine. He's been covering this. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
What makes Mojo Vision's prototype so newsworthy?
So there aren't that many smart contact lens makers out there. None of the major, like we all know that Samsung, Sony, companies like Magically, they all have patents for smart contacts. And so far, just about Alphabet Verily is the only one that we know is working on a smart contact lens for, you know, the average consumer maybe, or for specific individuals. They are one of the few that have actually showed us some kind of a prototype with an interface that we can actually see. And also they're a company that sort of just existed publicly existed in the last year. They sort of just announced that they existed as a company last year, even though they were founded about 5 years ago. And this was the first year in January at CES, or a week or after CES is when they first said, this is what we're working on. It's a smart contact lens. So it was kind of surprising, but, you know, not wholly unexpected because they had been sort of teasing this mini display technology last year. But, you know, I was able to try it out, and it's definitely, I haven't seen anything else like it because there really isn't much else like it. But it is still very much in a prototype phase. So we're expecting like an actual thing that would come to market, a contact lens that will come to market maybe in like a year, 2 years, 3 years.
In the process, and I want to get to what your experience was, but in the process of all of this, the company that we're talking about, Mojo Vision, also has been working on lenses for people with low vision or people who are like legally blind, who don't see light very well. The FDA fast-tracked those lenses. Why is the FDA interested in those?
So essentially all contact lenses, whether they're smart or not, have to be FDA approved because they're medical grade devices. And so whether this company wanted to make one for the average consumer or they wanted to actually help a particular demographic of people with, you know, medical assisted devices, either way, they would have to get approved. So they're sort of working on their first prototype is going to focus on helping people with, you know, low vision or visually impaired people to sort of help them see in particular environments. Say if it's super dark outside and you're walking down the street, wearing these lenses will be able to sort of boost the highlight, the contrast, and just sort of make everything look a little bit more visible, almost kind of like night vision, but not entirely like that. But it basically makes them allows them to see a little bit better in the dark, especially. And so that would be something that obviously would be very helpful for people with, you know, low vision. And so that's something that the FDA sees. Basically, the FDA has this program called the Breakthrough Device Designation. So if it's a product that can potentially help people in a dramatic way that would help them live a lot better, they'll sort of put that into that program so they can sort of fast track the review process and sort of get something to market as fast as possible. So whether this will be the first prototype and then the eventual consumer version, we're not entirely sure yet, but that's what they're working on right now. And then it might be that, you know, that same version will be the consumer facing one that they intend to release sometime after that.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the future of contacts today. My guest is Julian Chokatu. He's senior associate editor at Wired Magazine and covered a concept rollout, at least, from Mojo Vision. It came out about a week after the CES, Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, earlier this month. Right now, the FDA, as we just talked about, is fast-tracking the lenses because they are apparently effective or could be effective in helping people with low vision, and particularly when it comes to low-light vision. But they're also looking at developing smart contacts. And Julian, you said you tested these contacts or the concept of them using, I guess, virtual VR, virtual reality?
Yeah, so they did have a little prototype that they I could like sort of look through, a little contact lenses that I basically looked through and I could see text, and that was sort of the gist of what I could figure out would be what it looked like. And then they had me put on these VR this VR headset, allowed me to see the intended type of interface that you would sort of expect to see when you put those contacts on. And so the VR headset had sort of all things sensors attached to it. They had eye tracking sensors in there. So eventually the smart contact lens would also have tracking sensors inside it that would allow it to sort of understand where your eye is going, because obviously when you're looking through smart contacts, you don't want to see something right in the middle of your vision that would block what your field of view.
Uh-huh.
So their interface sort of works by, if you look to the left or the right or anywhere around the corner of your eye, you'll suddenly see a sort of interface fade in. And that's sort of a way to get things, sort of pull things up, basically, in the interface. Otherwise, when you look back to the center, it'll disappear and you'll be able to see immediately, you know, whatever's right in front of you. So basically a little pull to the right or left with your eye, and you can pull this interface up, and there's sort of apps alongside the entire corner of your eye. And you can pull things up like the weather. You can just gaze at something and it'll expand a little bit more to show you a little more information. So, for example, if you look at the weather icon, you'll see today's weather. And then if you sort of gaze at this little arrow next to it, you can see an extended 3-day forecast, or it applies to the commute times. You can see commute times and you can see something for work and from home. And it's sort of little things like this all around. I don't know how much of this is really final, but this is sort of what they're intending this, you know, sort of a consumer grade version to be, where you can sort of don these and get alerts also through your phone, like notifications. But they really think this is going to be something that would allow people to sort of be in the moment a little bit more, rather than sort of always pulling out your phone for something. Think also biking. When you're getting navigation alerts, you can sort of just look to the right quickly and see that it'll maybe just pop up quickly that say you have to make a left turn right now. So it was very responsive, but that was all through a VR headset. But so it could all completely be different when they put all that stuff inside the contact lens.
What kind of technology are we talking about? Is this just sort of like a miniaturization of what already exists?
Yeah, for the most part, it is almost entirely just miniaturizations of everything that we have. So there's like at the very center of the contact lens is one of the smallest displays that they have. And that little tiny dot display is what allows you to see everything. And eventually they'll have all sorts of those other sensors around, like eye tracking sensors on there, so that, you know, the eye knows, or the contact lens knows exactly where your eye is going towards. And things like connectivity sensors and image sensor. And the image sensor is what would allow, you know, when you're in a dark room, for example, for people with low vision, to be able to highlight those edges of, because so basically they had put me in a dark room to sort of simulate what it might look like for people with low vision when they're walking around, so that they could experience, walk around the town without having to really worry or lean on other types of devices or maybe a cane. For example, there was a stop sign in the hotel room and they turned off the lights, yet with looking through this prototype smart contacts, I was able to sort of easily read out the entire stop sign with no problem. I could see the edges of the bed. I could basically see people as well, and I could walk around the room without really, you know, potentially hurting myself. And so that's all helped through that image sensor, which is basically looking at the real world and then highlighting those specific areas so that you don't bump into anything and you can see things.
Have you talked to anybody who's concerned about putting things like these in our eyes?
So they did have a medical expert on their team that was there. So I was able to ask them a little few questions. And they did say that, they had tested this for, it's basically just light. And, you know, light is always coming into our eyes. And they had tested this for the amount of lumens that would be hitting your retina. And it was way under the limits, federal regulations. So they are saying that it's a very safe product. But obviously, I'm sure there's always more research to be done.
And the idea of having smart contact lenses that could be like a little, you know, a smartwatch in your eye, I guess is kind of the way I'm visualizing it. What about that? Having to look around the, you know, I guess you want to have good peripheral vision.
But,
yeah. I mean, are the contacts themselves, are they imagining or are they working on something that's like disposable contacts, the hard glass contacts that I grew up with? What's the makeup of the contacts itself? What are they working on?
So at the moment, what I saw was one of the harder types of contacts, so not really like the bendy ones that most people probably use.
Yeah.
And really, it's early days, though.
Yeah.
That's more or less what all they showed me. And at the moment, they had mentioned that it's going to be powered using this other wearable that you're going to be wearing on your wrist. But eventually, they sort of plan to make all of that connectivity happen through a smartphone. But again, super early days, so I'm sure by the time something comes out in a year or two, whenever they're ready, it might be different already.
And is this something that's going to be affordable, do they envision, or is it going to add like so much technology, or at least the way it used to be, is so expensive and only a few people can afford it?
At the moment, I mean, they didn't mention anything about price yet, and I'm sure they weren't ready to share anything like that, but I'm sure, like all technology, it'll start out being super expensive, but we already know that there are some other companies looking at stuff like this. So I'm sure once they come out, there will be other companies that also start coming out with their own versions, and eventually maybe there'll be high enough demand that you know, they'll start having competition and lots of other companies making this stuff, and hopefully there will be a more affordable version at some point. But yeah, I don't expect any of that, like a proper affordable version to be available at least in the next 5 years, maybe 7 or so years.
And, you know, that's ostensibly right around the corner. Where does this fit in, do you think? I'm just asking you, Matt, suppose in the whole trajectory of not just wearable, but physically, and you know, we're becoming one with the technology versus something you can take off at night, wearable technology.
I mean, I think this is definitely pushing us towards that I think I would say goal, which seems like that's something that we, or at least the direction that we're all heading towards, is that, you know, we are getting married with our technology. And of course, you always see that kind of stuff in sci-fi shows. I think there was even a Black Mirror episode about
it. I'm sure there was.
Yeah. So I'm sure, you know, I think it is exciting, but of course, there's always going to be worries about how far you might go when you're doing all of that technology, and just how integrated it is going to be becoming into our world, and how things are going to be hackable, and they're hopefully a little more secure than current devices. And so there's all sorts of things that obviously we'd be worried about, especially, of course, like you had mentioned before, like medical reasons as well. Like, would you really want to put a smart contact lens on your eye all the time? So it's just one of those things, I think, that as more and more devices come out that really have you putting them on your body all the time, or other parts of your body, I don't know. I'm sure we'll just have more questions and concerns as time goes along. But eventually, I think it might become mainstream enough that people might be comfortable with using them.
Julian Chokatu, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Julian Chokatu is Senior Associate Editor at Wired Magazine. We've been talking about, you know, a prototype or a vision of smart contacts coming in next several years, but still they're starting to work on them. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Dairy farming in Ohio is turning to robots in some cases. Jason Neufer uses robots on the dairy farm he co-owns with his parents. The farm, Barley Jerseys, is in Willard, Ohio. Jason Neufer, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Also, Brian Wise is with us. He's the chief of the dairy division of the Ohio Department of Agriculture. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Jason, I wanted to turn to you first. I mean, when we talk about robots, it's not like the guy on Lost in Space. I mean, they're just robotic, roboticized machines, right?
That is correct, yes.
What do they look like?
They're actually not very big. It's just a small, kind of a box. Just about the size of a cow, just enough room for them to come into this area. It dispenses feed in there for them to eat. And then there's an arm that holds the milking unit that comes under the cow, and it does all the prep and the sanitizing and attaching of the unit. Once that cow is milked out, then it sprays a sanitizing post-dip on the cow and lets her go out the other side. So basically just a computerized arm that does the work and a couple gates.
There must be sensors, right, involved in this, because not every cow is created the same.
There is. There's a lot of technology that goes into proper attaching. So kind of the overview, I guess, of how it works is when the cow comes into that area to get milked, she wears a collar with a transponder on it, so it identifies that cow and knows who she is.
Okay.
So it then knows what information to collect and send to the computer and if she can even be milked at that time. But once that cow is attached, it saves those coordinates to where it attached onto her teeth. So when she comes in the next time, it knows where she was at. And so when the laser scans to look, it starts at that position, so it constantly updates those teeth coordinates so to make attaching faster. So we have memory and we have an actual laser that scans to find the right position.
There's so much more I want to ask you, but first I want to turn to Brian Wise. How many Ohio farms are using this technology now, Brian Wise? Do you know?
Yeah, currently we have 61 farms that are utilizing robotic milking technology. We also call it automatic milking installations. And on those 61 farms, we have 195 units. And by units, a farm might have two robots or four robots on those farms. So of those 61, there's 195 total units in operation today.
And when did this start? Is this a fast growing option, or has it been rolling out slowly? Can you describe that to me?
Yeah, so in the state of Ohio, the robotic milking technology started being utilized back in 2009. We had a farm near Marysville that decided to start using robots. So that was the very first one here. Now, nationwide, it started right around 2000 was when the technology kind of got adopted and utilized mainstream, I'll say. There were some variations of it back in the mid-90s, early 90s that were used, but those were not very reliable units. So the iterations that you see today on these farms really was around the year 2000 when they started.
What is, I describe from what we've read that getting the humans, there are more expensive ultimately than the technology?
The robotic units themselves do have a cost.
Yes, of course.
So it depends on each situation, you know, how they want to utilize the robotic milkers. And it varies by family. Sometimes the family doesn't have any labor source available, and they still want to be able to milk cows and still have a life, have a family life. So they adopt the robotic technology that will operate without a human being present. They milk 24/7, 365 days a year. Then there's other situations where it's a larger farm and they just, you know, again, a lot of it comes down to labor, but they don't want to have to deal with the labor. So they'll utilize the robotic milking technology to allow them to milk more cows with keeping the same workforce that they currently have.
Okay. You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher, and we're talking about robots that milk cows today. Agriculture is the number one industry in Ohio, and Technology is a big part of that. You just heard from Brian Wise. He is chief of the Dairy Division in the Ohio Department of Agriculture. Also with us is Jason Neufer. He's an Ohio dairy farmer at Barley Jerseys Farm in Willard, Ohio. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Jason, what do the cows think?
The cows are happy. The cows adapt to technology probably faster than the humans do, to be honest. They do a really good job. There's very little interaction with the cows as long as they're doing what they need to be doing. And I guess the results kind of speak for themselves. Just the way that the cows perform and the way that they use the technology is quite impressive, actually. I was actually very surprised at how fast the cows took to it when we started 4 years ago. So I would say from a cow standpoint, it's been very successful.
Is it more efficient, the robotic milkers? Does it do it faster, I guess is the question.
I wouldn't say faster.
Okay.
There's a lot of, the process of milking the cow is basically the same no matter what kind of system you use. It takes a certain amount of time to prep the cow. It takes a certain amount of time to properly milk the cow. So we really can't change that. But what we can change is kind of how we go about doing that. But the cow, it's the same cow no matter how we do it. So we have to basically kind of do the same things to the cow. It's just a different way of doing it. So the speed per cow is probably the same. There's a lot of other advantages the robot can provide to the farm, the farmers, and the cows as well. So,
well, let me ask you this: before you had the robot doing it, how did you do it? Was it a human sitting there on the overturned milk bucket, like most Americans visualize it these days? I mean, what did it look like before the robot?
So my grandpa started that way, and then my dad built the milking parlor that we used before the robots, so we could milk 12 cows at a time in this milking parlor. So the cows all left their pen, went and stood in line to get to the milking parlor, so we could milk all of our 120 cows in about 3 hours through there, with about two people in that parlor the whole time to milk those cows, and we do that twice a day. So that's kind of how it went before. Now we have two units instead of 12 that milk all the cows, and those two units are open for business 24/7, except for three times a day that it washes. And we don't need any human interaction to actually do the milking process as long as it's working properly.
Well, what about leading the cows to the robot?
They go on their own. We don't make them go. They do their own thing. The robot is actually right at the end of the pen where the cows are at. So they all have their own schedule. They can do their own thing.
They know when they're ready to be milked?
They do. As long as they go and do their thing, we don't have to really make them do anything. And we have very, very few cows that need to be taken to the robot to get milked. So once they get the hang of it, get figured out, it's usually a pretty smooth process.
Brian Wise, you said that there's 61 farms in Ohio using this technology now. How many dairy farms are there in Ohio?
Currently, at the present time, as of January 1st, we have 1,813 farms in the state.
And what's the selling point to them? What are the kind of considerations that go into deciding whether or not to go this route?
That may be a better question for Jason to answer, since he is on that side of it. From the regulatory side, what we're seeing is, I think I mentioned it earlier, is a lot of it's the labor issues with these facilities not having a labor force available to come in to milk cows to work on the farm. Sometimes it even is simple as a milking parlor is just simply worn out and it's time to do a replacement.
Okay.
And this is an option for them. This is technology they can use. It allows them, again, to have a family life. You know, the kids have a softball, baseball game that they can now go to, or before they couldn't.
Right.
And there's different factors for every facility when it comes to building these or making this decision to utilize robotic milking. But ultimately, it's been adapted more so on, I'll say, on the smaller farms, the 120 cows, 100, 180, you know, 240 cows. A lot of times you see it in kind of installments of 60 cows. A robot itself will handle about 60 cows, give or take, during a 24-hour period. You know, but here lately we have seen some larger farms that are starting to utilize it again, simply for the labor force issues mm-hmm. that they're facing.
Yeah. So what, Jason Newfer, what went into your consideration? Was your milking, what do you call it? The parlor. The parlor. Was it worn out and you're ready to get replaced anyways and thinking about where to put your money?
That was part of it, yes. But for us, when we started to look at robots, like Brian said, the labor was our number one issue. And for most of the people that I know in the dairy industry, labor is the number one issue. So when we look at adapting this technology, very, very few times are we actually putting people out of a job that mm-hmm. could be milking cows. It's the fact that we just can't get anybody to do it. So like in our situation, my mom did a lot of the milking, and that was gonna come to an end pretty soon. I mean, she's getting to the age where she didn't want to do that mm-hmm. 6 hours a day anymore. no one blames her for that.
Mm-hmm.
And just getting consistent labor to milk cows is just very, very challenging. So when we started to look at the robots, it was for a labor issue that we had. But then we started to realize all the other benefits on the cow side of things, how we can better manage the cows and increase our cow comfort with the robots. So the advantages kind of presented themselves more after we started looking into them more, I guess, at that point.
You said it's been about 4 years. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, we were 4 years, December 1st.
Okay. Well, what are the other advantages? There's the labor issue. Is it more sanitary?
No, it's not. Sanitary is similar across the board. We're all regulated the same as far as moving raw milk and how it has to be handled and stored.
Uh-huh.
So there's no differences there. It's just from a cow standpoint, on the farm as managers, we can do it. For some of us, it's easier to manage with robots. Like, for instance, we milk our cows 3 times a day in the milking parlor. With the robots, we are averaging three milkings a day. But each cow is determined when she gets milked differently. So it's all based on her daily production of how much she can get milk. So, for example, if a cow that's milking 100 pounds of milk a day can get milked up to 5 or 6 times a day if she wants to go that much. So basically, we can get the same production from our cows, and they only have to carry a fraction of that milk throughout the day. They get milked more times.
And that's more comfortable for them.
It is more comfortable, right?
I'm just kind of fascinated by the idea that they know to go to the machine.
The feed that they get in the robot helps. But for the most part, cows enjoy getting milked. Right. I mean, they want a snack once in a while, too. But for the most part, cows enjoy getting milked. So it's not really an issue getting them in there at all. So,
Brian Wise, is this technology, I'm trying to think, all right, cows, milk, but is it potentially something that could be adapted to other parts of livestock, you know, farming?
Yeah, I'm sure there's other technologies that can be used. And I know just speaking of just some of the systems that we have on our dairy farms, lately the manufacturer of the robotic unit that Jason's farm has, they have a what they call a feed pusher. The system will run through the barn and push its feed back up towards the cows if you're in a freestall barn setup. So the cows have access to that feed at all times. It runs by itself on a schedule, on a track. It does its own thing. You don't have to worry about it. There's other applications in the feed area where they have applications where it'll mix feed and deliver feed to the animals on its own. So, I mean, on the farm applications for robotics, it's probably endless, really, what can be thought of. And I know even in our processing segment, the use of robotics is growing every day, it seems like, for making of your fluid products and your cheese, your ice cream, and those type things.
And Jason Newfer, do you think the cows miss the human interaction, or is that just us thinking we're more important than we really are?
That's a good question. And we are still with the cows. We just don't put the milkers on.
Uh-huh.
So we're in the barn. We're still in the barn quite a bit, doing other things, walking through the cows, making sure there's no health issues.
Mm-hmm.
moving cows here and there. So we're still around the cows. We're just not putting the milkers on. So
that brings
I would say the human interaction is still very similar as it was before.
You know, and that made me think of something else. Could these kinds of robots with their sensors detect, be useful in other ways while they're milking the cow? Could they be checked? I don't know what I'm talking about here now. Could they be taking their temperature? Could it be, they be doing anything else to monitor their health and overall well-being?
Yes, that's a very good question. That's one of the other huge things that robotics do is they monitor hundreds of things every day for that cow, and they send it to the computer so that we can look at it. And some of those things are like that chain transponder on her collar that IDs her also monitors her rumination activity, so how much she is chewing her cud every day.
Uh-huh.
That's an indication of health. It also monitors her activity. That can be an indication of an illness or also indication if that cow might be in heat and need to be inseminated. And then during the milking process, we are collecting all kinds of data from the milk itself as far as health goes. So we look at a lot of things on the milk as far as quality goes, mm-hmm. and mastitis goes. Milk temperature is one of them. Conductivity and color of the milk, so we can make sure that there's no mastitis issues there. And then all that milk is collected, sent to the computer so that we can look at it on different lists and determine if any cows need attention as far as the health goes.
Yeah. I have a couple calls, so a couple listeners calling in, so let's hang on. Kyle in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Kyle.
Hi, Ann. Thank you for having a program, and the guests are mentioning some of the science that might be successful for their parlors. So if a goal would be to help and just as much your neighbor-to-neighbor kind of farm activity, do most of the types of aspects that you would have to repair some of these as readily available, do you really work on those if they need to be repaired within your community? Can you find sources of techs that can help you achieve your yield to help to keep those up and running?
Yeah, that's a good question. Another option for developing, employment around them. Jason Newfer, what do you say?
Yeah, so the dealership that we purchased the robots from has technicians on call 24/7. So anytime that we have an issue, we can contact them anytime during the day and get help. Oftentimes I can fix it, or oftentimes if I need to just call them and we can talk about it on the phone, we can get it going. If not, they are available to come out for a service call anytime we might need that. So preventing downtime is important for all of us.
Yeah.
So, and they understand that.
Kyle, thanks for that question, because it's interesting. I mean, you think about all the different kinds, you know, they say computers are the future, robotics and that kind of a thing. And a lot of people don't think of it in these kind of terms, particularly on our Tech Tuesday show. But Bill in Westerville, you're on the air. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just kind of curious as to whether you lease these robots, or do you buy them? And if so, what's the cost?
Yeah. Jason Newfer?
Currently, I don't know of any lease programs available, so we do purchase these. And kind of the cost somewhat depends on the installation procedure, depending on where you're putting them in your facility. But it's about $500,000 for two. So.
And they're worth
quite,
it.
Quite expensive.
Yeah.
It's quite expensive, but yeah, I wouldn't go back. I'll put it that way.
Okay. All right. Good. Thanks, Bill. Diane and Hilliard, you're on the air. Welcome, Diane.
Hi. I was wondering how they clean the facility and how frequently between each cow or I don't know.
Yeah.
That's
a good question.
I just wondered how they clean it.
Yeah. Jason?
Okay. So after each cow is milked, that unit is backflushed with water and cleans out, basically just flushes it with water to clean the milk out where the cow contact would be. But three times a day, the whole system shuts down and does a whole wash with detergent and hot water through the whole system. So we do that three times a day. And then as far as just the area around the cow, we hose that down and clean that up at least twice a day whenever we're in there.
Thanks, Diane, for that call. Jason Newfer, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks for having us.
That's Jason Newfer. He's an Ohio dairy farmer at the Barley Jerseys Farm in Willard, Ohio. And Brian Wise, chief of the dairy division at the Ohio Department of Agriculture. Thanks for your time as well. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you for having me.
More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The fake versions of Apple AirPods Pro earbuds are so convincing, even a tech expert can be fooled. A shopping trip on Facebook Marketplace sent our tech expert, Russell Holly, looking for new AirPods Pro, but he was duped by a very convincing counterfeit. Russell Holly, contributing editor at Android Central. Welcome back.
Hi.
What happened?
I met a stranger in a parking lot, a lovely gentleman named Fred, who said that he was moving to Android, was picking up a Galaxy Note 10 and was getting rid of his AirPods, which was cool because I had just lost my AirPods and needed to replace them because I used them a lot and they were at a pretty decent discount. So that was probably the first warning. But I went and I picked them up and I put them in and I used them and they sounded just like AirPods for the first couple minutes. And then I went to use some of the features in AirPods. And it turned out that those features didn't work. And it took me a little while to figure out why those features didn't work. And it was because the headphones were not actually made by Apple. They were made by another company. But they did such a good job with the counterfeit that a bunch of the software on the phone didn't know that they were fake headphones. And that was what really kind of threw me was that, all of the software or most of the software that goes into making these still thought that the headphones I was using were real and made by Apple.
Wow. I mean, that suggests all kinds of things. First, though, you weren't just happened to be walking through a parking lot and met a guy. You purchased them online and met the guy in the parking lot to get them, right?
No, I paid for it. Like, I handed him cash. This was... a deal on Facebook Marketplace, just like, something you would do on Craigslist.
Right, right.
Like,
yeah. Okay. Gotcha. Yeah.
Do the exchange. He had them, he was selling them and I happened to be nearby. So I said, let's meet up here in an hour and do that.
Was it a good deal or did you get ripped off?
Well, I mean, as far as, kind of basic Bluetooth headphones go, they're okay. But yeah, they were a little expensive for what I would normally pay for kind of basic Bluetooth headphones.
So your first clue was that it didn't have some of the features that your old ones did, or your real ones did, I should say.
That's right.
Is that something that what you would have done if you would do it differently? You would say, wait a minute, I want to check these out first, right?
Yeah, so I mean, I did check them out first. I lifted up the lid and I waited for them to connect to my phone. And there's a very specific thing that only AirPods do when they connect to you to an iPhone. And that happened. And I went through the menu and that all of the menu things that I was used to were all there. It really was until AirPods Pro have the ability to activate what's called noise cancellation. And when I went to activate that noise cancellation, well after the person I had sold these headphones to had left, it didn't work. And I thought that maybe it was, it was a software thing. I remember that early versions of the AirPods Pro, had to have a software update. So I went to try and update the software because we update software on our headphones now. Thank you, 2020. And it didn't work. The software update, there was no way to update the software. The button that is normally there to update the software wasn't a part of the menu because there was a certain part of the phone that knew that these weren't real, but most of the phone thought that they were. And so it took me a while to get there, to figure that out. But then I started taking a closer look at the headphones themselves.
Yeah.
And that was when I realized that the the battery amount, you know, the amount of battery that was inside the headphones in the battery case was not correct. The number was incorrect compared to normal AirPods. Hmm. And then the light, you know, there's a light on the case that lights up when the phone is charging. Mm-hmm. And it was a different color.
Huh. So is this becoming a problem? Have you heard, since you've purchased these yourself, have you heard that this is becoming a problem?
This was something that I had heard before, and I will admit that I kind of rolled my eyes a little bit, because there are tons of companies that make headphones that look like AirPods. You can walk into any convenience store or kind of simple music store or something like that, and you'll find earbuds that look sort of like AirPods. But if you look at them for a minute or two, you can tell that they're not really.
Mm-hmm.
They're just made by another company to look like them, because the AirPods have become kind of a fashion statement.
Mm-hmm.
These were, the case looked exactly like them. It said, made or assembled by Apple in California, made in China on the back of the box. The case, the print was all in the correct places. This was a concerted effort by a company to make these counterfeit headphones to sell to people who thought that they were getting AirPods.
So what's the moral of this story?
Don't buy things from Facebook Marketplace, like electronics. I'm sure that there are some things that you can buy from Facebook. I've bought, like a desk,
exactly.
For my kid's room.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing is fine. If someone counterfeits a desk, you still have a pretty decent desk. I would not buy electronics from Facebook Marketplace. That would be my warning to most people.
Okay. And what about Apple? I mean, are they interested in these counterfeiters by any chance?
I'm sure that Apple is interested in them, but I think that there's limited scope as to what can be done, through services like Craigslist and the Facebook Marketplace, because these transactions are not being made in a place where it can be, validated by any kind of financial institution. My bank is not directly involved in this. These are largely cash transactions. So once they happen, there's just not much that can be done.
Do you report them on Facebook Marketplace?
I did report them on Facebook Marketplace.
Good.
And then I also told the person, who was still very friendly with me on Facebook Marketplace, wanted to let me know that if I had any problems with the headphones, that he'd be willing to help me out. And I thought that was extremely generous of them, but the problem that I was having was that they were crap. And then he was less interested in talking to me. So
I see. Well, thank you for sharing. A lot of people don't like to share those kind of stories when they buy a bad car, a lemon, or something like that. So thank you, Russell, for doing that.
Yeah, no problem.
Speaking of earbuds or headphones, Amazon's Echo Buds, they have their own earbuds. They launched them late last year. Was this something that you saw at the Consumer Electronics Show or what?
No, this was something that Amazon announced at their own event late last year, and it actually took them a little while to ship them out to people, even though the pre-orders happened pretty quickly after the announcement was made. And these are, in the very same way that Apple AirPods are headphones that give you access to Siri on your phone,
mm-hmm.
These are headphones that give you access to Amazon's Alexa on your, through your phone and through these headphones. So if you are deep in the Alexa ecosystem, instead of needing, one of those little hockey pucks nearby when you go to call it out, you can just say it or press a button on the headphones and have access to the Alexa service wherever you are, which is of limited use when you are outside of the home. But that's something that Amazon has been trying pretty hard to work on.
Uh-huh.
The biggest thing here is, these are actually pretty decent earbuds for $120 that do noise cancellation, that have battery that'll last a couple hours on a single charge, and a case that will recharge them while you are not using them. It's worth pointing out that Apple's AirPods Pro, which offer a pretty similar feature set, are $250, and these are half the price. These are $120 headphones obviously don't have the look and appeal of AirPods, but they're equally as functional and they sound really good. So it was impressive to see how much work had been done here for half the price of Apple's headphones.
Are they comfortable?
They're pretty comfortable for me. I had to, they come with a bunch of different tips that you put on to make sure that it's a good fit in your ears. And I am kind of picky about those. And so it took me, one or two tries to get them so that they were comfortable. But once I did, I could keep them in my ears for a pretty decent period of time and not have to worry about them, being painful or anything like that for a while.
I wanted to turn to a caller right now who from Marsh in Upper Arlington. Hi, Marsh.
Hi there. My question is about Instagram and counterfeit. I noticed, particularly over the holidays, companies were running ads on Instagram, and they literally were going and stealing legitimate content from the real company's website and replicating an entire site, doing everything else but selling counterfeit or just pure scam products. Is there any way to sort of look for clues in that to see what may be going on to avoid those kinds of things?
Absolutely. You know, this is a problem that Instagram and Facebook as well have had for a while now. Artists are regularly ripped off in particular. If someone is selling a design, you will frequently see that design show up on a shirt and then be promoted through Instagram or Facebook without the artist knowing. And obviously during the holidays, that gets cranked up a little bit, something that Instagram claims to be doing, you know, an active job of looking at. The best solution that I have been able to find is to grab a screenshot of that thing on your phone, or if you're using a computer, kind of right click and save on whatever that image is, and then through Google or through TinEye or other services like that, perform what is called a reverse image search, where it allows you to upload that image and it goes and it finds where that image came from. This adds a couple extra steps, but I found with regular frequency, I would take these ideas and I would upload them to the reverse image search, and I would find the actual provider of that content, and then if I still decided that I wanted it, be able to purchase from them instead of from this unofficial third party.
What about the social media platforms regulating these things more?
That's something that we have been calling for Instagram to do for some time, and Instagram, and Facebook as well, say that this is something that they're working on, being able to kind of ferret these out before they are live and taking people's money. But honestly, it's something that's been happening for so long, and it never feels like it happens with any less, decrease in frequency. So I struggle to believe that Facebook is really actively working to resolve this problem.
Okay. Marsh, thanks for that call. It's interesting. We don't have a ton of time, but I wanted to ask you about the Google story. Google's going to be charging law enforcement for helping out. What is it that law enforcement goes to Google for?
Sure. So Google will go to law enforcement, or law enforcement will come to Google for data requests. If there's some information on location history for someone who has been using Google Maps a whole lot, or voice requests that come from a Google Home, that someone's been using a Google Home service for in their house to do things. These requests can be made in the event of child safety investigations or life-threatening emergencies. Google will provide that information, responding to things like wiretaps and search warrants and things like that.
And they want to charge law enforcement now.
So the issue that's come into, as a former Google lawyer explained, these services were designed with other services in mind. These were not services that were designed to provide information to law enforcement. So it is a time cost, to go and find this information in the format that the police want in their warrants. And that time, is time that comes from an engineer. This is time and service that has to be provided, and so those costs had previously kind of been waived, but in very much the same way that police or that law enforcement agencies are not reimbursing for the work done in Freedom of Information Act requests and things like that. Google is kind of doing something that feels very similar, in that the energy that goes into these requests has to be paid for somehow. So
do you expect others to follow suit? We're just about out of time.
I would definitely think that this is something that we see more than one company do. It wouldn't surprise me if Amazon follows suit pretty quickly.
Russell Holley, as always, illuminating. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Russell Holley, contributing editor at Android Central. That's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.